Later that night, as he retires to his quarters to dictate his last will and testament, Adolf Hitler will state,
"My wife and I choose to die in order to escape the shame of overthrow or capitulation. Moreover, we do not wish to fall into the hands of an enemy who requires a new spectacle organized by the Jews for the amusement of their hysterical masses. Therefore, it is my wish, our wish, to be burnt immediately on the spot where I have performed the greater part of my daily work in the service of my people."
It will be 4 a.m. before the Supreme Warlord finishes his political statement. It rambles from one subject to another. He appoints Admiral Dönitz to succeed him at the head of the new Reich government. He praises the common German soldier and again curses the general staff for having betrayed him. But in the end, he will continue to hammer away at his one guiding obsession.
"The Jews alone bear the responsibility not only for the millions dead on the battlefield and in the bomb cities, but for their own fate, which they brought on themselves. They started the war. They caused misery and death to millions of Europe's Aryan peoples. Therefore, they had to pay. Though my means were far more humane than they deserved.
I demand of all Germans, all national socialists, men, women...
To the last, he is the fanatical, hate-filled street agitator. He is proud that he has never weakened. And above all, he will conclude,
I enjoin the leaders of the nation and those under them to uphold the racial laws to their full extent and to oppose mercilessly the universal poisoner of all peoples, international Jewry."
Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Mike King back on the show. Of course, Mike is a self-described thought criminal, a researcher, a historian, author of many books that challenge the official narratives of history. His website is dedicated to that mission. It's the Real History Channel, correct?
Yes, Real History Chan. Chan.com. Oh, Chan.
Okay, realhostychan.com. Yeah, I'll provide a link.
Sure.
When I post this. Okay, you wanted to so you recently published this new book or booklet on Adolf Hitler's suicide note, his last will testament. I think it's titled Hitler's suicide note, final testament of Adolf Hitler. Now, I think as far as popular culture goes, what the general public understands about this, point of the war, this point in history, they've seen through movies, right? Like most history. Recently, I think, is Downfall. I think it was made in 2004. A German-Italian production. I saw it. I enjoyed it because it was more from the German perspective, and of course, it was also in the German language, and it was well shot. And this was played by Bruno Ganz, the actor. A lot of people know him on YouTube because a lot of people will take that scene where Hitler loses his temper, learning that his orders had been followed because the armies didn't exist. And so they apply it to different scenarios. We all have a good laugh at it. Yeah. So this Hitler in the bunkers has become sort of a meme that's been abused and used throughout history. The first thing I recall seeing it was when I was a kid watching The Late Late Show, Hitler's Last 10 Days, was a movie came out, in the early 70s. This was being run in the 80s. I think it was Alec Guinness played Hitler. And it was kind of a similar thing, Hitler in the bunker. Of course, at that point of the war, the Allies are closing in from the West. The Russians are actually in Berlin. You can hear the shells going off, the artillery fire occurring, and it's it tells the story of Hitler's inner circle in the final days of the war, and of course Hitler's eventual suicide with his wife Eva Braun Hitler. But you have an analysis of this last will and testament, and I'm going to let you take it from there.
Sure. Well, I mean that's another one of the myths about his final days, is that he basically breaking down, lost his mind. There's no historical basis to that at all. To the contrary, everyone who was there, he just remained calm, cool, and collected till the very end. He was a very strong man. I mean, this whole idea, and he just flipped out and lost his mind, which is consistent with the lie that he was always a madman, you know, is completely untrue. And he was always in charge of his faculties, even as his physical health from all the stress was breaking down towards the end. And that really comes across in the final testament. And, you know, what's really astonishing, Tim, is I came across this document in 1998, shortly after getting my first computer, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. It's a completely authentic document. I mean, of that, there is no question. But what's remarkable is you can study history, as I had even prior to my awakening, even though it was mostly fake history. You can study history, you can major in history, you can read every book on World War II and see the documentaries. How many people, very few people, are even aware, forget about having read this document, very few are even aware of its existence. And that's truly amazing, because this is the most significant newsmaker of the last 100 years, 200 years, really. Okay. That's why Time magazine named him Man of the Year 1938. That's before the war even started. It was a hit piece, but Man of the Year back then meant newsmaker of the year. So the idea of a historical personage of such significance leaving a final testament, in essence, a suicide note written the day before his suicide, and nobody knows about it. It's just completely ignored. And there's a reason for it, because I'm sure if many people read it, they would begin to have the same awakening process that I did when I stumbled across it 25 years ago. Because you read it, it's very brief, only a few pages. It's not what I had expected back then.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, let me interrupt you for a second here.
Sure.
It's almost similar when people bother to read the translation of Hitler's justification for his declaration of war on the United States. You get his side of the story, so to speak, Germany's side in that conflict. And it's when you read his arguments, like, okay, there's a point here. Can we all calm down and listen to it? But of course, we're not allowed to do that because we're just fed the propaganda. But it's kind of a similar experience. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, it is. It's essentially saying, I'll just read the opening lines for you right here. He starts out, he says, more than 30 years have now passed since I, in 1914, made my modest contribution as a volunteer in the First World War that was forced upon the Reich. And then when you research World War I, you find that it's true. It was totally forced upon Germany. Germany did not want the war. Then he continues, in these three decades, I have been actuated solely by love and loyalty to my people, et cetera, et cetera. Then it goes on. Okay. It is untrue that I or anyone else in Germany wanted the war in 1939. It was desired and instigated exclusively by those international statesmen who were either of Jewish descent or working for Jewish interests. I have made too many offers for the control and limitation of armaments, which posterity will not for all time be able to disregard, for the responsibility for the outbreak of this war to be laid on me. I had further never wished that after the First World War, that a second against England or against America should break out. And it just goes on. He protests his innocence and he tells of the days leading up to the start of the war with Poland and all the frantic efforts he made to get the British and the Poles to, you know, to talk and avoid the war. So it's remarkable. And the words ring true. And then when you research further, into original sources or independent sources, you find everything he says is accurate. And what I do in Hitler's Suicide Note is I produce in the beginning pages the entire testament. It's only a few pages. And then after that, I break it down paragraph by paragraph and I quote unquote fact check it through other sources, original sources, even hostile sources. And I'm able to confirm for the reader clearly that what he's saying is true. For example, when he says that he tried everything in the final days leading up to the war to avert the situation and make peace with Poland and reached out to Britain. And you'll never believe where I found confirmation of that. Take a guess.
New York Times.
You got it. Yeah, I pay to have access to like the last 150 years of the New York Times. I get access to every article, and that's what I do. But I pour through, and you see the headlines of the final week of August 1939. New York Times headlines, day after day. Berlin thinks there is hope of peace. Berlin open to negotiate, et cetera, et cetera. It was remarkably objective because the U.S. was not in a war at the time. And it wasn't until the war started that they began to spin things. But here it is. It's right in the New York Times. The Germany's offers reaching out to Britain and France. And then later on, even after the war started, through third parties like the Vatican, just to have a sit down before this thing got out of hand. So you've got the New York Times, the Jewish-owned New York Times, which was totally pro-World War II once it got started. But, you know, just to maintain the illusion of objectivity, they had to put out quite a bit of truth in those days. And I'm able to seize upon those truths and confirm the bulk of what Hitler wrote in his final testament. So, you know, it's really a red pill. The booklet that I put together is only 50 pages. It gets right to the point. I add a lot of commentary and illustrations. And once you read that, that really begins to open the mind and prepare somebody to later move on to my main book on World War II, The Bad War, which was a bestseller at one time before Amazon banned it. But this booklet is extremely powerful. And it's only available, Amazon won't carry it. It's only available at my website, realhistorychan.com, paperback, hardcover, or PDF.
You also write about some of the decisions taken in the final days of his rule in the bunker there, and that is his decision to expel Hermann Göring and also Heinrich Himmler.
Yeah,
I guess what he perceived as betrayal or treason for their negotiations. You take an understanding or sympathetic explanation for Göring and Himmler's moves, not so much treason as it was naivete, like they could negotiate something, get a better deal by negotiating with the Western allies. And you say that Hitler wasn't so naive in that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was a common sentiment among, you know, many of the German high command in the military that, because the war is lost, why don't we make a deal with the Western allies and at least present a united front against the Bolsheviks? And, you know, superficially, that seems like a reasonable approach. But it wasn't, because ultimately what happened, well, first of all, it was already agreed upon as far back as 1942 that the Soviets would take Berlin and all of Eastern Europe. So there was no averting the Soviets getting half the country. And secondly, what went on in the West in that period after the war, the months and even a full year after the end of the war, was just as brutal and horrific as what was going on in the East at the hands of the Soviets. You had the Germans surrendering in droves to the Allies because they didn't want to be turned over to the Soviets. Well, what did Eisenhower do? He put them in camps and he murdered 1.5 million of them through deliberate neglect, exposure, and hunger. There were also rapes in the West, and anyone who was a Nazi party member, so-called Nazis, were rounded up. Many of them were executed. So make no mistake, what the Americans imposed upon Germany was just as bad as what the Soviets were doing. The only difference is, the Soviets raped every woman in Berlin, an estimated 2 million rapes, whereas the women raped by Americans is estimated at, quote, only 100,000. But it was brutal. Either way, it was going to be a very brutal and murderous and genocidal surrender. And that is why it was impossible for Germany to make a surrender. Okay, there was no way that Hitler could say, look, I'll agree to exile, I'll leave, and we'll make a negotiated surrender. No, the terms were unconditional surrender, which entailed the Soviets getting half the country. So,
isn't that what motivated the July 20th plotters too? The idea that they take out Hitler, they could negotiate a more reasonable.
Yeah, that was part of it.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people had that mentality, thinking, well, it won't be so bad with the United States. You know, our main problem is the Russians or the Soviets. And that was, they were deluded. And I don't regard Himmler and Göring as traitors so much as, like you say, in that way, they did not see what Hitler saw. Hitler saw exactly what was coming. But as for the assassination plot, there were always some officers in the German military whose heart wasn't into it, the aristocratic ones, the ones who really didn't care for Hitler's egalitarian system that gave everybody a shot.
These were the Prussians.
And right? what they did, that was pure treason, because that would first of all, the war wasn't really lost at that point, even though the tide was turning. But that would have kicked off an internal civil war right there. So that was pure treason, and they were, executed as they should. But I'm sure some of the people involved in that plot probably also had that mentality of, let's make a deal with the West. But there was no deal. The deal was already struck as far back as 1942. Soviets get half, and the Western allies get the other half. And there was murder and starvation and executions in all the occupied places.
Yeah, the Western occupation of Germany kind of gets a whitewash in history because perhaps the Cold War. So once the Cold War started, the anti-Russian propaganda was useful. The information about the brutality, of the advancing Red Army, and it served the interest, of the Cold War at that point to play up the the atrocities on the part of the advancing Red Army. But yeah, not many Americans are aware of what occurred in the western part, occupation zones. You mentioned, of course, the Rye-Meadow camps that Eisenhower oversaw in contravention of the Geneva Convention and all rules of decency and fair play. Patton was enraged by it. Ones the German soldiers that were held by Patton were treated relatively well. Compared to those who fell under Eisenhower.
Well, after the surrender, he released them. Once
yes.
made the May 8th unconditional surrender, Patton just said, okay, good luck to you. Go home.
So, and that might have contributed to Patton's assassination.
Certainly. Yeah.
He said
Patton was going to come home. He was going to come home and he was going to start a movement. He was a fighter.
Yeah, I was just reading about the liberation of France and there's a good book about that called The High Price of Liberation or Freedom I think it's Hitchcock is the author's name. And he talks about much of the destruction that occurred in France during the war occurred in the latter half of 1944 when the Germans were being kicked out by the advancing allies and the destruction of their small towns and sort of had a jarring effect on French culture. It still has never recovered. How in retribution, how many hundreds of thousands of people were murdered, by communists, so-called French resistance. And these were, alleged collaborators, people who just were getting on in life. And then the 4 years during the German occupation, we know about the women having their heads shaved, but there are, hundreds of thousands of murders that have been, undercounted, scores settling in these things during that liberation, so-called liberation period, of June through, I guess, September or October 1944.
French towns, wiped off the map by Allied bombardment. And then that continued in Belgium and in Holland, too. So that was the method of warfare of the Americans and the British is just kill them all, let God sort them out.
Yeah.
And some of the towns didn't even have German soldiers in them. It was just brutal.
And even some of like the slave, like the fact that a lot of labor was used, they call it slave labor. And there are some typical accusations of, harsh treatment and these things being exaggerated. But of course that narrative is belied by the fact that after the war, you had several reunion parties of French laborers and their German captors. Couldn't create much sense. And these people simply, what was called slave labor, was people being requisitioned or called up to work, and they're looking for work and being fed. People don't realize during the war, of course, a lot of people are hungry, so they'll do anything to get by and work. But there was labeled slave. This justified the fact that after World War II, a lot of Germans were sold, carried off into slavery, by the French and also by the Russians, after the war. So, but the you talk about here with the outbreak of the war itself, and he talks about the origins of the war. Of course, Hitler's experience during World War I factored into his entry into politics. And you talk about how, of course, in both wars, wars seemed to be brought upon Germany by the British Empire and the financial power that controlled the British Empire at the time. And he talks a lot about, he calls it world Jewry, international Jewry, international Jews.
The international Jewry, he used the term international hyenas.
Yeah.
He's talking about the globalists.
Yeah. And other people had talked about this too at the time, contemporaries like Henry Ford, even Winston Churchill in another context talked about it. But again, what we call globalism, right? And we call, the New World Order globalism. This is, I guess, what Hitler is talking about at the time.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it is the same battle that we face today. Today we call them globalists. We used to call them one worlders, but it's the same crowd. He called them the international Jewish bankers, because at their core you have people like the Rothschilds, George Soros, etc. And this is what many modern day, right wing people don't always appreciate, that Hitler's war was the same war. that we fight today. And Germany's only crime, quote unquote, was in resisting the New World Order and kicking these globalists out of Germany and cleansing Germany of the Marxist cancer.
And this is, of course, what they did. You know, this is what the Freikorps did. And you had a lot of these street battles with communists in the 20s and early 30s. And this is what the brown shirts were, virtually, or the SA. In his last will and testament, he makes a reference to what was going on in Weimar Germany and what had been done to Germany as sort of a justification for his coming to power. And can you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah. After World War One, which the Germans were tricked into surrendering, they were told by Woodrow Wilson the term that he used, the slogan was peace without victory. Okay. Or surrender without victory. So the idea was that the Germans would just lay down their arms, go home, and then we'll make a nice deal. There won't be any punishment, nothing punitive like that. Well, when the Germans did exactly that and placed themselves at the mercy of the Allies, they came up with the Treaty of Versailles, which Germany was forced, quite literally forced, to sign at gunpoint. They were put on a hunger blockade, which was not going to be lifted until they agreed to these harsh terms. And this led to the hyperinflation. They carved up German territory. They took away limited the German military to just like a police force, but they also disarmed private citizens, were not allowed to own guns. So it was humiliating, it was brutal, and it brought about poverty and misery you wouldn't believe. And a parliamentary system that was dominated by social liberals and communists. Then came the Great Depression, which hit Germany particularly hard. So by the time Hitler is able to finally win enough seats and become chancellor, 1933, the country is destitute. They're on their knees. It's you can't exaggerate how bad it was. So, that is why he was elected. That's another thing people miss. He was democratically elected. We're supposed to believe in democracy, right? So he was elected, and then later on there were referendums where he got 98% approval. It's because he inherited this desperate situation and in very short order restored the economy, cleaned up all the filth and degeneracy of Marxism, and made Germany an independent state, kicked out the globalists. And that's what World War II is all about. And, again, he revisits this theme over and over. As far back as 1924 was when he wrote Mein Kampf, and the story never changes all the way to 1945 and the Final Testament. So
you have a situation you talk about the moral, the degeneracy and moral corruption of Weimar Germany that occurs. And at the time, I think Jews represented less than just over 1% of the population, but they, like in any other instances in other countries and other times, they had a disproportionate role in widely banking and in newspapers, publishing, finance, the professions, art and culture. And so at the same time that they have a leading role in these things, it's contributing to the degeneration and the impoverishment of the German people. And so if they are indeed enjoying a lot of power in Germany at this time, and Germany is collapsing or suffering under this, they'd have to harbor a lot of responsibility. That's one thing that Adolf Hitler identified. It's a similar situation today in the West, where they can enjoy a disproportionate role in culture, in the entertainment and the arts and finance. But then if you point out that everything's going wrong in the arts, entertainment and finance, they don't want any responsibility for it. But it is interesting that Hitler expels them, and all of world Jewry as it exists at the time declared war on Germany. And this was, of course, 1933. I forget which newspaper it was, a British newspaper, it said Judea declares war on Germany. Now, just the fact that such an entity existed informally, but they were able to organize an international boycott, speaks a lot about, at the time, what was then, maybe we see latent Jewish power, but at the time, Jewish power was very formidable in the West. They could organize an international boycott of Germany. Again, if Germans are the eternal, if Jews are innocent and eternal weak victims, how are they able to organize such a boycott of, you know, of a major European state?
Yeah, that's right. And it started pretty much the day he came into power. And he really didn't even have full power because they still had a multi-party parliament back then, but he was chancellor. And the agitation began from day one, for calling for the boycotts. He hadn't even done anything to harm anybody. And they're putting out all these stories about, you know, Jewish women are being raped and all this garbage. Yeah, anyway, it was all lies. It was all atrocity propaganda. So this is as far back as 1933. So this was a big problem. Then when you go to the loss of World War One, which had triggered all of Germany's problems, that too was engineered by internal Jewish traitors who ran the Communist Party of Germany, Rosa Luxemburg and so forth. The heads of the Jewish labor unions were organizing strikes during wartime. Then you had the Jewish-owned newspapers began watering down the war effort and demoralizing people because they wanted Germany to lose for two reasons. Because it would bring down the German monarchy and they can get a social democratic system or even a communist system. But also because a dirty deal had been made, the Balfour Declaration. They knew if Germany lost, which means Turkey loses too because they were allied with Germany, that Britain would take over Palestine and begin allowing the Jews of Europe to immigrate there. So once they saw there was something in it for them, there was a massive internal betrayal of Germany. So you have to understand that going back 50 years prior, or even before Germany was a nation, when it was Prussia and a bunch of federated states, the Jews had it good there. They had no problem. Nobody bothered them. And, anti-Semitism, so-called, only existed on the political fringe. So now you have to ask yourself, well, what happened after all these years of no problems? Suddenly after World War One, so-called anti-Semitism breaks out. There has to be a reason for it. And that reason is never discussed. The reason is they were stabbed in the back internally by Jewish communists and Zionists, and then also plotted against externally by Jewish globalists. So, you know, there's a reason for everything. Hitler didn't just wake up one day and say, let me pick on the poor little helpless, powerless Jews. It didn't work like that. It was the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, they gave it away. I was watching a clip of Ken Burns' latest documentary on Holocaust, where he blames the Americans for the Holocaust.
Yeah.
So no good deed goes unpunished, as they say. This is Jewish gratitude. So now the Americans are in the dock for the alleged Holocaust. But in there, he talks about Weimar Germany, and they talk about how great Weimar Germany was. It became the center of art and culture in Europe because of how progressive it is. How, you know, so, well, then, okay, so you are saying, and this was largely occurred at by the leadership of the Jews. So you're admitting the Jews enjoyed a leadership role in controlling the direction of German culture and film and these things. And so, okay, that's true. Then if you do identify these things as being degenerate or destructive of German culture or morality, you have to be held responsible for. And it says a lot that, you know, all Hitler did was expel them from these positions of leadership within Germany. He didn't arrest them and put them in camps at this point. The war, that didn't occur until the war started.
That's right.
And believe me, Germany wasn't the only nation that did that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, to identify a domestic enemy, a suspect population or minority, but the idea that, okay, so Germany says, okay, we're going to create a Jewish free nation, at least free of Jewish control. At that point, instead of saying, okay, leaving Germany to its own devices, they organize an international boycott and foment a war. which speaks to the neuroticism of Jewish power, how it reacts to opposition. Instead of negotiating and acknowledging that perhaps they'd gone too far, and they brought it on themselves. This is something they never consider. They always remember there's a reaction to something, but they never say what's the action to the reaction. And at the very least, Germany was reacting to something, and you could not deny what occurred in Germany in the 1920s and 30s. Degeneration of society, the young women are being sold into prostitution, even boys, and this is being celebrated. You had all this weird sexual experimentation, like the Magnus Hirschfeld, which was one of the first operations that the Nazis destroyed. His experiments in transgenderism, of course, we see that today. Yeah. So it's one of these things, again, where this is the one nation where there's a reaction and they're expelled. Of course, it wasn't the only nation. I think there have been 108 other times this has occurred in history, recorded in history. So
that's right.
Germany isn't unique here. But they react by saying, okay, we've lost Germany. Let's regroup. We can still conduct our affairs in France or in Britain or in the United States. They have to pounce on Germany. Again, that's a narrative most people don't see, because most people are given sort of this calcified, most people's understanding of Hitler and the war is sort of this calcified blob of World War II propaganda and post-war propaganda. So they don't have an understanding of these things. And your work and these things, they kind of lay out the arguments, at least lay out the argument, lay out the facts and the counter arguments, at least the other side of the story. And you realize there was an other side of the story to this that was going on. And so it's just, again, people, again, are just given the sort of this caricature of Hitler and of Germany at the time. And they're just evil, right? Their history is villains. And no consideration, no empathy can ever be shown to Hitler or the Germans of that time, lest you, be called a Nazi as well. So
that's right. Well, it's just he really did defeat them for a while, and it was something they never expected or saw coming. And for that reason, just his name to this day seems to strike a bit of terror in them. So they have to still keep digging him up and beating him, but you can't. He's a legend. You can't kill him.
Well, what about he seemed to revive Germany within a couple of years. And people have written about this. He made certain moves against bankers, the Rothschilds. He reformed the currency, backed by German labor. And within a few years, Germany was enjoying full employment, whereas the West was still mired in the Depression, particularly the United States. Do you want to get into that a little bit, how we revived the German economy?
Yeah, I mean, that's another untold story. I mean, this is the depths of the Depression. And right away, things began improving. And within 3 years, things were so good in Germany. Even outside observers from other countries were coming there, and they were just astonished at the recovery, just the economic recovery, the social recovery.
Lloyd George, right? That's the former prime minister of Great Britain, had some favorable things to say about Hitler.
Yeah, he did. He had an amazing quote where he says he's never seen a more happier people than the Germans. And, Hitler is a national hero and so on. And even Churchill, though he was beginning the process of warmongering and writing articles in 36 and 37, he had to acknowledge what happened in Germany and how great it was. And then he put his poison pill saying, well, we still don't know how it's going to end up, but even Churchill had to acknowledge Hitler's great achievements. Here's a quote from Lloyd George. This is a former prime minister of Britain. And he wrote an article in a British newspaper titled I Talked with Hitler. And he went to Berlin, he visited Germany, and he told of his experiences. And he writes, the fact that Hitler has rescued his country from the fear of a repetition of that period of despair, penury and humiliation has given him an unchallenged authority in modern Germany. As to his popularity, especially among the youth of Germany, there can be no manner of doubt. The old trust him, the young idolize him. It is not the admiration accorded to a popular leader. It is the worship of a national hero who has saved his country from utter despondency and degradation. To those who've actually seen and sensed the way Hitler reigns over the hearts and minds of Germany, my description may appear extravagant. All the same, it is the bare truth. And it goes on and on. I mean, this is something you would think, Goebbels wrote, okay? But no, this is the British Prime Minister. And there's many others who made that observation. And, you know, it was only a matter of time, Tim, before people in other countries, you know, they're mired in the depression, start asking themselves, hey, what's going on in Germany? What are they doing that we're not, you know? So this had to be stopped, you know, just like when Napoleon banned the lending of money at interest, or he tightly controlled it more than 100 years earlier. They had to gang up on France. You don't mess with the money lending operation. But the recovery was phenomenal. And in that same year, Germany had a referendum. They held a referendum. They still had a parliamentary system. It was dominated by the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the so-called Nazis. But the question on the ballot was, instead of individual seats, you just vote for a national clean slate. So it would be 100% Hitler's people. Okay? So just a total clean slate, or just keep it the way it was with the multi-parties. 98.2% of the country gave a resounding vote of approval to Hitler by voting for the clean slate. So this gave Germany total, every single, like 500 seats in the Reichstag, all held by the National Socialists. So you talk about democratic, but this is the kind of support he had, 98%. I guess there's always 1% of people who are insane or whatever, but that is the degree of support. These were not rigged elections. The man was idolized and worshiped. It wasn't due to brainwashing or anything like that. It was due to results. To turn a country around like that in such a short period of time.
Well, I mean, to the extent that the German government that's in power would engage in what's called public relations, we call it propaganda. But look at our situation today with the news and politicians and what they do with polling and, you know, the manipulation of public opinion. I mean, as early as the 1920s, Walter Lippmann was writing about how public opinion has to be manipulated and created. It doesn't really exist in the democracy. People are constantly manipulated and brainwashed. Edward Bernays. Yeah. Two Jews, of course, right? And today, to what extent we say we have elections, we have free speech and the free press, but look what's coming out today in our liberal democracies today with Twitter and the role that the various alphabet soup agencies have in manipulating not only public opinion, but also public perception and manipulation of the facts and any number of issues. Can I turn on the station and watch RT television in the United States? Oh, yeah. That was taken off the air.
Yeah.
Can I watch press TV? See what the Iranians have.
Can you find Mike King's books on Amazon?
Exactly. It's like how many books have been banned from Amazon? Taken off Amazon's list. How many people have been shadow banned? Their accounts shut down because their politics or what they say isn't what the regime wants. So please spare me. Maybe liberals would have an argument if they lived by their supposed convictions and principles. But the moment they're confronted with a counter argument or meaningful opposition, they shut you down.
Yeah.
You know, did Father Coughlin in the United States, was he allowed to broadcast and mail his newsletter? No, he was shut down because the FDR administration didn't like what he was saying.
Right.
You know, so spare me, please. Right? I mean, it's but the fact, yeah, we do hear a lot of things. We say that one thing, that Hitler was a brutal dictator, but he had mesmerized and the German people. Well, which is it then? Because if you have them mesmerized or controlled, you don't have to brutally oppress them, do you? Yeah. Which is it? you have to admit he was popular. You know, and even with the you Yeah, yeah, it's in your book. You write about these sort of these diplomatic maneuvers that he pulled off in 1938. You know, which is now they've been demonized, like the taking of Austria, reuniting with Austria, and also the moving into Czechoslovakia. There's details of that where Czechoslovakia sort of dissolved, because that was sort of a creation of the Versailles.
Yeah.
Thing we never should have been created in the first place. It doesn't exist today. Now it's Czech and Slovakia, and you know, so you had a situation in Austria where the vast majority of Austrians wanted to be reunited united with Germany as Germanic peoples, and that's just simply following the principles of Wilson's 14 points, self-determination. But that was denied to the Germans in 1918-1919. But most people's understanding of that is like through the Sound of Music, right? It's like,
yeah,
that's people's understanding of these events. Do you want to talk about those? Because that was sort of considered a prelude to Hitler's bid to take over the world, moving against Austria and Czechoslovakia when there was no such thing, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and there, shortly thereafter, there was a referendum on that too. And 99% of Austrians approved of the merger. They wanted to be part of Germany. They didn't, you know, they were under a Western globalist puppet government. And you know, who was anybody to tell these people you can't unite with Germany? So it was sort of like when the Crimea voted to become part of Russia again. Mm-hmm. That was 97% a few years ago. So there was, everybody was so happy. The only people who weren't were the Jewish regime. They fled. Louis Rothschild, who was the biggest banker in Austria, he was put in prison. And Kalergi, Count Kalergi of the infamous Kalergi plan, he fled. You know, the guy who wanted to wipe out the white race. He wrote about it in the 1920s. So, you know, these were the type of scum that the very small 1% minority were opposed to Hitler.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, with Hitler's defeat, eventually Kalergi's plan is implemented, as we're seeing it today.
Well, there you go. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And so, and that was critical. And, you know, Kalergi in his book, one of his book, he acknowledges, he gives gratitude to the people who supported him and helped him. And he names Rothschild, Louis Rothschild, Warburg, mm-hmm. and Baruch. He met with these people in New York. Mm-hmm. So he actually told us who his handlers were by giving gratitude to them.
Yeah. He wanted to break that ethnic identity, especially at the national level. Of course, Germany would have been a primary target in that. Of course, Hitler, of course, wanted to create a German Volk culture. Unified German Volk culture, unifying all Germanic peoples, and you know, of course, that is sort of pathologized or characterized into, you know, him creating a master race that's going to conquer the world. And again, that is just a cartoonish propaganda. Yeah. You get that from watching Steven Spielberg movies like Indiana Jones. it's a bit more. I would say that Hitler's views on race were probably pretty much the same as people's views at that time, whether they're wrong or right. His views, and Winston Churchill wasn't any more progressive, you know, Hitler was in that regard. I mean, if you want to take a critical view of it, but it turns out, you know, it's simply that, again, this stuff has been, a narrative has been created, ever-changing narrative, if you will, from that war. And it's, again, Hitler the madman, obsessed with race and these things. And again, it's just not something that's that really comports to reality if you have to look at the facts and these things.
Yeah.
But the,
so that was the story with Austria. Czechoslovakia was similar. The Sudetenland was just this long strip of territory that was should have been part of Germany or Austria after mm-hmm. they carved up the map. But for some reason, they made it part of this newly created patch-up state of Czechoslovakia. And, you know, they do these things because they're like, these globalists are good pool players. A good pool player doesn't just focus on his shot. He wants the cue ball then to be positioned in such a way that he can make his next shot. So they're always looking ahead for the next war. So they create these crazy situations, and Sudetenland was one. It was 97% Germany. It's a long strip of territory, has no business being part of Czechoslovakia, but it caused a lot of trouble. So you have this fake state, which is part Czech, part Slovak, and that's where it gets its name from, Czechoslovakia. But they forget that the second largest minority after the Czechs was the Germans. Mm-hmm. But they just leave that out. So it should be Czecho-Germano-Slovakia. But even when that state was dissolved, the Sudetenland became part of Germany. And then the Czechs and the Slovaks got their own independent states. So everybody was a winner.
And then Poland took a big chunk, didn't they?
Oh, Poland went in with their tanks.
Yeah.
Poland, they took a piece.
Innocent Poland.
Yeah, yeah. Just like they took a piece of Lithuania. Poland was very aggressive at that time. But nobody would say anything to Poland because they knew that they were going to need its military dictator, Edward Rydz-Smigley. They were going to rely on him to start the war, especially after the Czechoslovakia. I mean, that's where they wanted to start the war, but it didn't work out thanks to Hitler and Neville Chamberlain. So then they went back to the drawing board and they said, okay, our last shot is Poland. And they used the ultra-nationalist dictator of Poland to pick a fight with Germany, leading him to believe that he would get support from the West. And that support never came. They never gave a damn about Poland. They just used its foolish military dictator to pick a fight and thereby establish the pretext for kicking off World War II.
It didn't, even after the Polish campaign, didn't Hitler send out several olive branches to the Western powers?
Well, yeah, because the Polish war, that war ended in about 3 weeks. So it was over. But the declarations of war remained in effect. Hitler said, okay, it's over. Poland's done. I mean, you're not seriously going to go to war over Poland. He couldn't believe it. But they were going to war because Poland, and Hitler even said it, Poland was just an excuse. It was just a pretext. And that's why Poland was abandoned after the war got started. So, and he continued to plead for peace and make numerous offers, make offers through third parties. This went on all the way until 1941 until, it became obvious, especially after Pearl Harbor, which FDR induced, all throughout 38, then when the war started in 39, 40, 41, numerous, at least a dozen proposals off the top of my head I could name for you. They all amounted to the same thing. No war. We don't want anything. So these proposals are real. And again, a lot of those you'll find in old issues of the New York Times.
You get the impression that if you read the contemporary news reports is that for the most part, people thought of Germany and Hitler as sort of a normal statesman that you could deal with. It's really only after the fact that he's treated in such a way, to the point where he's the embodiment of all that is evil,
Yeah.
He's the incarnation of Satan himself, right? And
yeah,
they
had to proceed cautiously, even though you had the Jewish and the communist fanatics in this country. The country was still overwhelmingly anti-war. So newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, they had to proceed cautiously because of that.
Here's the difference.
Doing so, they were forced. They put a lot of poison pills in their news, for sure. But yet, there's a remarkable amount of truth about the situation that you can read in 1938, 1939, 1940 issues of the New York Times. And I love using that stuff because, if people say to me, well, where did you find that? Who said that? Goebbels? No, New York Times.
The difference is you could say that that Hitler and the Third Reich called for the expulsion of Jews from Germany, particularly expulsion from positions of power. I think they weren't even expelling them totally. They encouraged emigration.
No, the idea of expulsion really only once the war started.
Yeah, once the war starts, that's a whole other matter.
That's a whole right.
That's a whole other thing. Yeah. But I'm saying initially, it called for removal from positions of cultural, financial, political leadership.
That's right. That's right. I mean, they still, the Jews still lived in Germany and they did very well commercially. It just, they could no longer control the newspapers and the theater and the government and the banking system.
Which they admittedly did use to promote degeneracy, progressive that's liberal ideas, if you will. I mean, that's admitted. So let's, so we don't want you doing that. You're destroying the country. You're undermining the morality of the country. And no society can function if people are living immoral lives, because society collapses. Even Stalin acknowledged that. They got rid of the wacko Jewish ideas, like the feminists. Stalin put an end to it because they're destroying family too, and they realized that everything was just collapsing. And that's what was going on in Weimar. It's just going on in the West today under these people. But the response to that is like Germany Must Perish, right? That book by
that's an actual booklet,
which received favorable reviews from the New York Times, if I recall.
It literally called for the extinction of the German race through sterilization, banning of the language. I mean, it was open call for genocide, and a lot of the elements of that you'll see in the so-called Morgenthau Plan, one of FDR's top advisors or handlers. And the Germans knew this. They had copies of this book. And that Morgenthau Plan would have been far worse than anything that Stalin ever imposed in the East. Mm-hmm. And the only reason it did not go into effect is that there were some sane people in the West who blocked most of it. But the plan was total deindustrialization of Germany. They were to go back to like medieval times and just live like Amish, you know? It was just horrible.
I think Morgenthau himself admitted that he was willing to accept like a 30-35% drop in the German population. I mean, death.
That's right. Yeah. Attrition, starvation. And Hitler knew this, and maybe some Germans didn't believe it, but Hitler knew this was coming. He had no way of knowing that it would be blocked, but that was the plan, that level of extermination. So Germany could not negotiate a surrender. It wasn't a normal situation where you say, okay, spare my people, make a deal, I'll go into exile or something like that. No. It was, we're coming for you. Germany must perish. That was the deal.
And this is why Germany...
with Japan too. So this is why, fake history portrays, the Japanese and Hitler as a sort of fanaticism that they would not surrender. And they got so many people killed that didn't have to die. Well, the reason they didn't surrender is because the lies, I call them, the Allies, all lies, kept demanding this unconditional surrender, which means we come in, we take over your country, everything, communications. Well,
we see that today.
Germany
and Japan today, they're not independent. Obviously Germany isn't. They let their pipelines get bombed and don't say anything about it. And they're a NATO member.
Yeah.
Now I know coming up on an hour here, his decision, he gets married and within 40 hours he commits suicide with his new bride. A lot of people said, why did he do this? And you have something to say about the rumors or the theory that he escaped to somewhere down in Argentina.
I find that so annoying. There is like nothing to that story. Third party hearsay. He said, there's nothing to this Argentina business. They have the body. They did a forensic exam a few years ago on the teeth. But of course, people who promote that theory will say, well, that was faked. Okay. All right. Very well. But the whole idea that he somehow escaped is predicated on the notion that what the Soviets recovered was an unrecognizable body because it had been burned on his instructions. Okay. Well, how do you make the leap from that to, he must have escaped? Because think about it. He doesn't want to be paraded about Red Square, either live or his corpse. You saw what they did to Mussolini just a few days earlier. They strung him up. They beat his body, him and his mistress. They strung him up upside down in a square in Milan. Hitler doesn't want that. So of course he's going to give instructions to, you know, burn my body or put it somewhere people can't find it. But, you know, Tim, everything we know about the man, he was a man of unusual courage and valor. I feel as if I know the man intimately, having studied him for so long. The idea that he would write a testament like this, where he says, I will stay in Berlin and share the fate of my people. I will not cowardly capitulate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then bug out the back door like a punk. It's just so incongruent, inconsistent with what we know of the man. And then the woman who took the dictation and typed it out, the final testament, her name is Trottle Jungle. She only died like 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There were witnesses or bodyguards. He's, you know, on the basis of a couple of vague statements and some, what I call Elvis sightings in Argentina, you know, this little cottage industry sprang up of Hitler escaped, and he lived until 1966. And there's some accounts he even had children. There's absolutely nothing there, of that I'm certain.
Well, didn't they clone him and then they get a resurrected?
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
The boys from Brazil, you know.
Yeah.
Like he can.
But you can see how a rumor like that gained some steam, because there were a lot of high-ranking officials who did escape.
Yeah, there was, you know, the so-called rat line, and the Vatican played a big part in that too. And that's been, yeah. And there were negotiations.
Mengele and Eichmann. Yeah. So, you know, some people did escape. So you could just see how some local villager could say, "Ah, the Führer's up there too," you know.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen him. Yeah. Because there's been a lot of speculation about Martin Bormann, because he was never found. And,
yeah, he's blown up. I mean,
there's a lot of lurid stories about, you know, like redoubts in Argentina, and because there's a large German community, and it's interesting. But yeah, but then again, if you look, those are only intriguing if you buy the narrative of the Second World War, and you start questioning the overall narrative of the war, they become less attractive. And, you know,
Yeah.
Because it's not a, you know, it's something out of sci-fi or something. Yeah, but it didn't rise these things. So his decision to take his own life, he just wanted to be. You don't think would have gotten a fair trial at Nuremberg?
I don't know. Maybe he could have talked his way out of it.
I mean,
oh my God, yeah.
Right, there was it.
I'll tell you, it would have been something to hear him speak at Nuremberg.
Well, Rudolf
Hess. Rudolf Hess, who took the dictation from Mein Kampf,
he gave
a hell of a speech.
Didn't Goering performed well too, from what I understand?
They all did. And you know, the guys who were hanged, they knew their fate, and none of them really buckled. Some of the lower guys buckled. The one guy, the Auschwitz commander, but God knows what they did.
Well, they tortured him, didn't they?
Yeah.
You're talking about
Rudolf Hess, he got up there. He said, it was my honor to serve the greatest son that Germany ever produced. And if I had to do it all over again, knowing that I would be burned at the stake at the end, I would change nothing.
Yeah. Well, Hess was in England for most of the war. So.
Yeah. And they put him in jail for life. I think they
probably killed him when he was like 87 years old.
They killed him because Gorbachev, you know, Soviet Union's falling apart. He's basically saying, you know, let's just let this guy go. And all along, the British were playing it like, well, we think he should go free, but the Soviets won't allow it. And then when the Soviets said, let him go, they were like, oh my God, you can't have him. Imagine him going free and giving interviews. Well,
he was a war criminal because he tried to fly to England to get peace.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah.
And that was on April 1940.
He was murdered. He was murdered before Gorbachev could release him.
Yeah. But he's, I mean, they called him a war criminal for flying to England to try to secure peace. However, unrealistic that was, he was lured, I guess, by there are factions within Great Britain who he thought were friendly, at least more congenial or, to Germany. These things, but yeah, that was probably a trick. But it's, you know, it's like, wait, he was gone. Even if you accept the official narrative of the Holocaust, he wasn't even in Germany when that was happening, like supposedly the official narrative.
Right. Yeah.
So, So, okay. So, anything else you want to cover here, or just where they can get the book, or?
Yeah, well, I definitely, people, this, I'm telling you, is such a powerful little booklet, and it's ideal for, like, you know, I know a lot of people who listen to our shows, they're also activists in their own way in their small circles. If you really want to give somebody something to begin to pry open the mind, this is the book, Hitler's Suicide Note. And again, it's and it's got an awesome cover. I don't know if you see the cover there. It's a cover of the actual document. You know, with a bullet and some blood stains on the front. It's available 8.5 by 11. It's like a coffee table booklet. And it's also in a hardcover, or you can get the PDF at realhistorychan.com. At the very least, sign up for the free report, How to Respond to an Anti-Conspiracy Theorist. It gives all the good pithy comebacks to all these idiots who say, well, that's a conspiracy theory, you know, and it also gets you on the mailing list. So, but that's it. Realhistorychan.com is a very unique site. And I specialize in taking what seem like vast, complex subjects and just boiling them down real concise and easy for people to understand and come up the learning curve very quickly. And a lot of what at my site also is news, current events. So it's not just history, but history ties into current events. And my motto is, fake history is the fake news that has passed into the rearview mirror. That's realhistorychan.com.
Excellent. Well, listen, thank you, Mike.
Okay. Tim, we'll do it again. Thank you.
Let's go. Take care. We'll perhaps talk soon.
Sure. My pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.